from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In 2008, Amanda Lindout was a 27-year-old with a hunger for experiencing remote places, trying to make it as a freelance journalist. But shortly after arriving in Somalia, Lindout, along with photojournalist Nigel Brennan and their guides, was kidnapped, subjected to horrific abuse, and held for ransom for 460 days. She's chronicled her experiences with her co-writer, Sarah Corbett, as a hostage in the book A House in the Sky, and both of them will join us to discuss the experiences and continued work in Somalia and Kenya up next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Amanda Lindout grew up poor in rural Canada. She was a high school graduate and waitress who set out to see the world and make her mark as a freelance journalist. She was kidnapped in Somalia in August of 2008 by armed Islamic fundamentalists. She was 27 years old and kidnapped along with Australian photojournalist and ex-boyfriend Nigel Brennan, a translator, and two drivers. She and Brennan were held hostage for ransom under brutal conditions for 460 days until a ransom was paid and they were released ultimately. Along with New York Times Magazine writer Sarah Corbett, she's written a memoir of her life and her ordeal called A House in the Sky, joins us here in studio for this morning's second hour. Welcome.
Good morning.
Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Glad to have you both with us. Amanda, let me begin with you because actually the book begins with your story before, well, this dreadful, hellish experience that you went through in Somalia, taking us to many countries, backpacking through many countries, but also inspired by National Geographic. Let's begin there. That's really what got you kind of footloose and moving across the globe, really, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in a poor household in a small agricultural city in central Alberta, and traveling wasn't something that my family did. So the world to me was the images that I saw on the pages of National Geographic magazine, which I kept in a stack beside my bed. And it was the images that I saw on those pages which inspired me then as a young woman to take myself out into the world and to seek out those very places.
And you went to so many places. I mean, you backpacked, what, about 50 countries?
Yeah, yeah, over 50 countries by the time I was 27.
And actually had some, difficult problems in some countries where one could almost expect difficult problems. Afghanistan held up with a gun, and I guess it was Iraq where you were forced to go to an ATM and give somebody money and held for that kind of ransom again, yeah?
No. But yes, in Afghanistan, there was an incident where I was...
there wasn't anything in Iraq, no?
No.
Okay. But of course, then you went to Somalia. And of course, many people say, why Somalia? I mean, particularly since it was going through an insurrection at the time. But maybe that was what drew you, in part?
You know, what we've endeavored to do with the book is to answer those questions about how it was I came to be there in 2008. And I think it's important to understand the childhood, the longing to be out in the world, those early travels, to understand who I was in 2008, the year that I was abducted. I was an adventurer. I was a free spirit. I had spent most of my 20s with a backpack on, traveling around the world and pushing the boundaries, crossing borders, and finding myself in countries which are conflict zones. And it wasn't that I was seeking out conflict per se. It's that my confidence as a traveler was growing the more borders that I crossed. And then in 2006, when I met an Australian photographer, Nigel Brennan, in Ethiopia, I was inspired by what he was doing, which was taking photos of the cultures and people that he was encountering as he traveled and selling them back home. And I thought maybe that was a way to make meaning of my travels, to share what I was experiencing with other people. And so that then led me to countries like Afghanistan and Iraq, where I was hoping, and did have some small success doing that, to share those stories with other people. And it was the summer of 2008 with a focus on telling those sort of humanitarian human interest stories that I had my eye on Somalia, a country where a lot of the major news organizations have stopped sending their foreign correspondents. And that creates opportunities for young freelancers to go in and tell these kind of important stories.
You were writing mainly for a little newspaper in Alberta at that time, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I was, and I was also doing TV journalism work. So I had all kinds of experiences doing that, including a stint working for Iranian state media, which isn't as much fun as that sounds. But then later was working for a French television station out of France, France 24, and filing stories for them. And so it was as a freelancer with limited outlets that I went to Somalia, but believing I would be able to tell and share a story that mattered.
As it was called then, the most dangerous place in the world, Mogadishu. And Sarah Corbett, before we get to the Somalia story itself, this is a story, I mean, you two have worked closely together now. You've become close friends. It's, in many ways, it's a real story in itself. I mean, the wonderful bond that you two have developed and trust and so forth. The story is one of transformation, though, really, isn't it? I mean, this young woman, as she describes herself, spirited and, you know, be somewhat naive and but open to experience and wanting to experience a lot of things, and going through this hellish ordeal and becoming a different person.
Right, right. I think what drew me to Amanda's story initially as a journalist is that, like the best stories, it follows a certain trajectory. I think of it as a coming of age story. I was first drawn to Amanda, actually, not because she had been held captive and released, but because when I went to look into her background, I saw a video that had been posted on YouTube. And it had been posted by one of her former traveling companions. And it showed really what to me was a breathtaking look at a young woman who was free. It showed her riding on top of trucks in northern Pakistan, going up the Karakoram Highway toward China. It showed her in Calcutta, India. And for me, looking at that, I felt envy. I felt admiration. I've been lucky in my life to travel a fair amount, but I've always wanted more. And I think that that's a real vein inside all of us. And I think we live in an era right now where any young person who might want to see the world also might be really intimidated by the world. And what I loved about Amanda's story right from the beginning was that she was never intimidated by the world. And of course, you know, at some point going into Somalia, she has to rethink her relationship with the world quite profoundly. However, that spirit and that that freedom runs right through her story, right even until today.
It's also, I mentioned National Geographic, but inspired by Eckhart Tolle and a number of other sources. I mean, especially when we speak about spirit. It was so terrifying, though, reading, and this is a testament also to the writing abilities as well as your recall, just the moment that you were taken. I mean, these young thugs, essentially, guerrillas, whatever you want to call them, come out and they're armed with AK-47s, and there you are, vulnerable and taken, and not knowing what your fate's going to be, not knowing what's going to happen to you. I mean, it must have been just stark terror at that point.
Yeah, I think it was difficult to comprehend, in fact, what was actually unfolding. I wanted to believe that it was a robbery. And then when I realized it wasn't that, I wanted to believe I might be able to talk my way out of it. Maybe they would let me go. And I realized that I was in the country because I genuinely cared about the situation there. But that was not the case. And when I learned that there was a ransom demand made for my life of $1.5 million, coming from a family with very limited financial means, I also knew that it was not going to be over quickly.
Your mother really was a single, I mean, was struggling. I mean, you were doing dumpster diving, and that's all in the book and that's in your story, and kind of barely getting by. And here they're making these demands. The assumption being if you're a Westerner, you've got money or you've got sources of money, I suppose.
Absolutely. At the time that I was kidnapped, my mom was working as a cashier at a bakery making little more than minimum wage. So this $1.5 million that they were asking for was as as impossible a demand for my family in many ways as it would be for a family from Somalia.
Your mother is really an extraordinary heroic figure to me as a reader. I mean, Lorinda, just her absolute and maybe you get that genetically, I don't know, you know, but her relentlessness in working to free you and doing all these things behind the scenes, and it's a remarkable part of the story. It really is just an inspiring part of the story. I mean, it's a story of mother love.
Yeah, my mom was the primary negotiator for me. The Canadian government, the same as the American government here, does not pay or facilitate the payment of ransoms, though the government helped my mother as they could within the confines of Canadian law. It was upon my mother to be the negotiator for me, and she did that. And she did that really, really well and tirelessly for 15 and a half months until she was ultimately able to raise enough money to get me out of there and bring me home.
We're talking with Amanda Lindout, co-author of A House in the Sky, and her co-author, Sarah Corbett, is with us, who is a contributing writer in New York Times Magazine. I don't want to necessarily get into the brutality and cruelty, the unspeakable events that you had to endure. They're all in the book, really. A lot of them are in the book. I mean, atrocities that are unspeakable. What surprises me and probably surprises a lot of people is that you seem to have forgiveness in your heart, that you have seen these young men as victims themselves of war-torn Somalia and of the insurrection that's going on and of fanaticism. And certainly one can make that case. But a lot of people would feel very differently. They want their heads on a platter, to put it bluntly.
You know, I've gone through many different emotions about what happened to me. And I worked through many of those emotions during those 460 days that I was a hostage, including anger and despair and resentment and why me and rage and hate. I went through all of that. Which led me to a sort of breaking point. That accumulation of negative emotion inside of me might have killed me in there. You know, I may not have made it out. It may have contributed to me giving up. I had to find an outlet for those negative emotions, and for me, it was going back always to that understanding that you just said, that they are very much a product of their environment. And that's just a fact. And that understanding helped me cultivate the sense of compassion inside of me, though that wasn't easy to get there. But it helped me because it helped me let go of some of those negative emotions that were building up inside of me.
But you still are haunted by these experiences, and you have PTSD, you have other, you know, physical ailments and so forth. I mean, you've suffered a great deal.
I have suffered a great deal, and it's not, you know, people associate my story with forgiveness because I have spoken about forgiveness a lot, and I think it's always important to clarify that forgiveness for me is an ongoing process. It's not something that – it's not a choice that I made and it just happened, like there's no anger left inside of me. It's something that I continue to choose every single day. And some days I get there and some days I don't, but it's what I choose every single day. And I think that one day I will live in that state all the time if I continue to make that choice. But my reality is that I have suffered extreme trauma, and there are reminders of that trauma all around me in the world as I navigate life, as my physical body is not the same as it was before. You know, my digestive system is compromised after a period of starvation. You know, I'm just faced with the reality that I have been fundamentally changed in ways both good and bad from that experience that I went through. But I choose forgiveness for myself and not for them, for myself. As a way of allowing positive emotions to be present instead of the negative ones, I choose it.
Sarah, how did it affect you hearing this story and the intimate details of this story, particularly from a young woman who you had admiration for almost right from the get-go? It must have had impact on you. I mean,
oh, sure.
Real emotional impact. Yeah.
Sure, of course. I first traveled to meet Amanda, I think it was about between 4 and 5 months after she had been released from Somalia, I went to where she lives in Western Canada in the Rockies, and I wasn't sure what to expect. I think we had maybe one or two brief phone calls before that, but I really didn't know who I was going to meet and what lay ahead for us. And right from the start, I mean, Amanda physically at that point was still quite ill and still processing what happened to her. And we also found common ground really quickly. And I was very curious what she wanted next in her life. And she right away started talking to me about not only the really specific challenges and horrors of what she had endured, but her hopes and her plans. And I walked away from that first meeting really committed to working with her. And it's been 3.5 years. And during that time, I have watched her start an organization that works inside of Somalia. She has dedicated...
We should mention the Global Enrichment Foundation, which, as I understand, has actually reached over 200,000 Somalis and also goes into Kenya. And has done some really extraordinary work, scholarships for women, funds for schools, building wells. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So congratulations
Thank
on that.
You.
I mean, that's really very inspiring and heartening, especially with what you've gone through. I'm not trying to, you know, dodge getting these details out of you, but I think in some ways people can use their imaginations here about just what kind of heart of darkness you actually had to endure, and read your book and find out if they're curious about it. I think the real story is in some ways the transformation and the forgiveness, but also survival skills. I mean, you and Nigel Brennan decided, for example, to convert to Islam. Now, this was really a survival move, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I just want to go back a step too to say there is. There is darkness in this book because darkness is what I experienced as a hostage in captivity. But there is also throughout this entire narrative from my childhood until the last page, the choices that I've made on the other side, this thread of hope, this undercurrent of hope through it all, including during the darkest times.
It's all in the title.
I mean,
it's what you saw in your imagination, a house in the sky, and I want to talk about that with the bird and all, but let me just get you back
So survival strategies were ever-changing and always evolving as our conditions deteriorated. And one of the first things that Nigel and I did together when we were still held together before we were separated was convert to Islam as a survival strategy. I had spent, at that point, 7 months almost living in Baghdad, so I was somewhat familiar with Islam.
But with the Sunni variety,
I had read their religious texts and had some understanding. And we made the request of our captors, one that I thought that they would probably honor. And in fact, they did. They allowed us to convert and then brought us an English Arabic Quran. And so what that helped us do was to understand our captors' starting point, how they thought about the world and what their beliefs were. And it also helped us converse with them about not only religion, every aspect of our kidnapping. We had the English and the Arabic text side by side. So it was really fascinating to begin to understand that. And as a survival strategy, it was certainly useful to Nigel Brennan as a male in that culture. I think it served him through those 460 days. For me as a female, you know, there were moments and times that it served me better than others. And as the conditions deteriorated, you know, perhaps by the end, that strategy wasn't really working for me anymore. But there were, you know, there were many, many different strategies just to get through the day, utilizing the power of my mind, trying to humanize myself to my captors, the conversion to Islam being some of them.
And then there's a daring escape, which is a narrative of that in the book, too, which in some ways led to more problems, because then you became, I suppose, they got even more enmity, more anger at you. But I want to get to that escape too, because it's a very important part of the narrative. Because you go into a mosque and there's a woman who you don't know and she doesn't know you, but who, another heroic figure, really, I mean, puts herself at great risk to try to save you. And I found myself in reading all about that thinking, because I know you haven't found her and would love to find her, what would you want to say to her? She failed, by the way. The captors retook you and so forth.
Yeah.
But if you could, if she were here right with us right now, what would you want to say to her?
I would thank her for the courage that she gave me to endure everything that followed after that failed escape attempt, because I thought of her every single day. And I don't know if that woman lived or died that day. The last time I saw her, as my captors were dragging me by my ankles out of the mosque, and she had thrown her body on top of mine until she couldn't hang on anymore, she was surrounded by men with guns who were angry that she dared to get involved. And for everything that
followed...
And
forgive me, these are the same men who, at least on one occasion, played Russian roulette with you with a rifle?
And, yeah. And everything that followed and all the punishment that I had yet to endure, I would think of her. And I would think of her extraordinary courage. So I would... I would want to thank her for that gift and that gift that I continue to carry with me through my life now, and which inspires me every day and inspires me to go on and do the work that I have been able to do with the Global Enrichment Foundation. I think she is also a testament to the incredible resilience and strength and courage of the women in that part of the world who have been oppressed for so long, of which I now have a firsthand understanding of what that's like. You know, there is a kinship I feel with that woman and with women in that country.
Let me also say something about your courage and resilience, because you were really at the brink. I mean, as anybody could understand with what you endured. But there's the story about the bird. Let's tell it before, because we're coming up on a break here. Another survival story.
Yeah, there was a time that I, after experiencing some particularly horrific abuse, that I made a very calm decision to end my life, where I thought, I can't actually physically continue enduring this. And I wanted to end my life on my own terms. And I had a rusty razor blade in my room that they had given me for personal hygiene. But before I used that to cut into my wrists, I wanted to think about the life that I had lived, and I wanted to remember my family. And as I laid there and did that, there was some movement that I, out of the corner of my eye, and I turned my head, and in this, from where I was laying in this dark room on this mat on the floor, I saw a small brown bird hopping around in this one square of light, which was just where the door was open just a foot. And I hadn't seen a bird at that point in over a year. And that bird to me was a symbol of hope and a message to hang on, a symbol when I needed one the most. And it completely changed things for me.
Again, we're talking with Amanda Lindout, and Sarah Corbett is also with us. The book we're talking about is called A House in the Sky, and we will continue this conversation. You are welcome to join us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with the authors of a book called A House in the Sky. Amanda Lindout was 27 years old, with a hunger for experiencing remote places, trying to make it as a freelance journalist. But shortly after arriving in Somalia, she, along with photojournalist Nigel Brennan and their guides, were kidnapped, subjected to horrific abuse, and held for ransom for 460 days. She has chronicled her experiences as a hostage in the book A House in the Sky, and is with us here in Forum talking about those experiences and her continued work in Somalia and her life. She's with us along with Sarah Corbett, the co-author, who is also a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. And there will be a discussion and signing this afternoon at Book Passage in Corte Madera at 1 p.m., where you can actually meet the author. I was reading somebody who compared you to, who said you look like, you've probably heard this before. I hadn't thought about it until you came in. It looked like Kate.
Kate Middleton. I get that all the time. Not a bad thing.
Not a bad thing, no. But, you know, in some ways, it occurred to me, and this is kind of a strange, odd thought, but you may have been lucky that you were Canadian rather than American. I mean, I know when you work for Iranian television, you found a lot of anti-Americanism, and certainly a lot of Americans go abroad and they go to places, not necessarily like Somalia, but they have to disguise their identity by saying they're Canadians because they know that there's a great deal of antipathy toward the United States. Was there among your captors?
No, there really wasn't, actually. I don't think it would have made any difference if I was from Norway or the United States or Canada. I was a white person who, therefore, in their minds, is sitting on endless amounts of money.
So, in some ways, it wasn't so much that you that they saw you as this Western woman infidel or anything along those lines. You were a cash for them potentially.
Nigel and I were both cash.
These are the same sort of brigands. Maybe that's too kind a name for them. Thugs who take over ships and so forth. The Somali pirates.
That's actually a whole different issue that's occurring in Somalia. My captors had nothing to do with the piracy that's happening off of the coast. They were a group of opportunistic young men, most of them teenagers, who were being controlled and manipulated by their leaders, their commanders, as they called them, who were slightly older and who had organized this whole thing to obtain millions of dollars.
And there was talk, if you would, just about the negotiations that went on. I mean, you said earlier your mother was doing all of this, so the onus fell upon her. But to a great extent, a woman of limited resources and so forth, what was she able to really do?
It's really extraordinary what my mom was able to do. She literally moved mountains for me. When it became clear that this was really only going to be resolved with money, she started fundraising. And she called up Canadian business people that she had never met before and pleaded my case. And the story was playing out in the Canadian media. So people in Canada were aware that I was a hostage. And many people responded to my mother's call for help. And many people close to me who love me gave up everything. My father remortgaged his house right down to the last penny. And simultaneously across the world in Australia, Nigel Brennan's family was doing the same thing. And so the two families were working together to collect this money to bring us home.
Back to your early history again. I mean, your mother was abused. And as a child, you had to endure hearing a lot of this. So you're exposed to violence even at that early stage of your life.
Yeah, I think my childhood made me a survivor from a young age because I needed to be. The household that I grew up in was often violent and always chaotic. We moved around a lot, which seems to be a theme in my life. But I had to learn how to survive. And I think that those same survival skills served me well later when I was 27 years old and taken hostage.
Sarah Corbett, what did you learn from this story? I mean, particularly in terms of your own life.
I think that having spent 3.5 years working very closely with Amanda, I have learned a little bit of that strength. I mean, I've learned about strength a lot, and I emulate her strength. Definitely immersing oneself in a story like this, you wake up in the morning and your own concerns might seem a little trivial, which was a good thing for me. I mean, I think Amanda talks about in the book quite a bit a ritual that she developed for herself in finding ways to feel gratitude, even in circumstances that most of us can't imagine. And that's one thing that I've really taken away from this experience is the power of feeling grateful for what you have and reminding yourself about what you have every single day. It's a good feeling.
This transformation that you went through as a result of this experience, Amanda, you've even said you've gone back to Somalia, you're working with Somalians now and everything. In some ways, would you say that this has given you a purpose in life that you didn't have when you were looking for that purpose?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that. I don't think I was so unlike other people in their 20s, actually, at the time that I was kidnapped. I was maybe making different choices, but I was a young person in search of a meaningful life, as most people are in their 20s, whether that's through university education or a job or a relationship. I was just seeking to understand who I was in the world. And then tragedy struck. And I was kidnapped, and I experienced horrific things there. But it made me ask the big questions about what I wanted my life to be. Should I be given another chance at it? And that's actually a real gift, to be able to step back and analyze your life and the decisions you made. And nobody will ever hear me saying that it was a smart decision to be there, or that I was the best qualified person to be there. However,
You've actually received a good deal of criticism along those lines.
You know? I sure have. Yeah. And I take that on. You know, it's legitimate criticism. And, you know, this book is my story. It is, it cannot be undone. And so I try now to make the most of it. And I have been given this second chance at life. And it is important to me to use this second chance to be of service in the world, and to make meaning both for myself and for others if I can, through sharing a story of survival and transformation and hope with others.
So let's say there's a young girl here who is like you were in her 20s and wants to experience the world and wants to take the kind of risks that you took, go to a place like Somalia, maybe even, let's say, Syria. Use that as an example. Well, there aren't many people who are doing upfront work as journalists in Syria, want to make my mark, win my bones as a journalist. What would you say to her?
I bet that young girl wouldn't listen to anything I had to say. But, you know, what I would say to anyone, young or old, male or female, who wants to go to these places is to really think about the what ifs, because that's something that I didn't give enough thought to. Who would be affected if something went wrong? Who would pay the price of that? I may have been willing to assume those risks for myself as a young person, but I don't think I ever gave enough thought to who else would be affected. My family, Canadian taxpayers. You know, there was a large ripple effect to those decisions. So I would encourage anybody wanting to go to conflict zones to think about all of those what-if scenarios and to be prepared for that.
Well, I want to give listeners an opportunity to talk with you and Sarah. And in order to move ahead with that, I'd like to once again let you know that there are a number of ways you can communicate with us and bring questions or comments right to us. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or post any of your questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle's @KQEDForum. And let's go to your calls. Carrie, you're on with us. Hi. Go ahead, Carrie.
Hi there. I'm from San Francisco. And I actually saw her story, I guess it was over a week ago. It was on NBC, I think, on television. And my partner and I were watching it. We were actually on vacation. And we watched it before I went to sleep. And I couldn't sleep the whole night. Woke up the next morning, talked to my partner about it because I was so overwhelmed by the story for two reasons. My mother is a journalist. She worked for ABC News and for Nightline for over 11 years. And we were always afraid she'd get sent to a war zone. She always wanted to go. We were always like, that's a bad idea. It's her kids. Not so great idea. And then me personally, I had a horrible case of breast cancer and almost died from it about 8 years ago. And I'm a photographer, and I put out a fine art series that's gotten well known. And people are always commenting on, you know, how'd you get through such tragedy? And it's so brave. And how do you get to the other side? And I always say to people, well, it's relative. I'm not in the Congo. And I use that as a reference because I think of how much worse my life could be if I was in a third world country, and even worse yet, kidnapped in a third world country. And so I was haunted for days by her story, because I honestly don't know how I would get up every day with the weight of the history of what had happened to me if I was her. And I just have such awe for her, even though I agree that she made mistakes and did things that she wouldn't do now and she was naive. But I think in the grand scheme of things, to be able to not just get up out of bed every day and get upright and move, but to put your story out there and let people see the pain that's happened and how strong she sits in it is phenomenal to me. I mean, truly phenomenal. And I just am so glad that you had her on today, because I wanted to be able to say that to her 2 weeks ago when I saw her story.
Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call. David asks, after your experience and insight into the stream of Islam your captors believed in, how do you feel about the religion and its adherents? I'm sure you've been asked that a lot.
Yeah, sure, I have been. I understand that my captors are not a reflection of Muslims around the world. They were a small group practicing a very fundamentalist form and interpretation of that religion that is not representative of most Muslims around the world. So I feel much about Islam as I did before I was kidnapped. And I continue to work with Muslims every day through the Global Enrichment Foundation, and I don't harbor animosity in my heart for Muslims.
You don't seem to really harbor much animosity in your heart, period, if I may say so. I mean, especially given what you went through and what you were subjected to. As I said earlier, I think it's a testament to the kind of heart you have, because many people would, of course, be unable to move beyond rage. And wanting justice, I suppose, too. I mean, in fact, at this point, I suppose the Canadian government has not been able to bring any kind of redress or justice, have they?
No, and I've had to accept that justice in a country like Somalia is going to be hard to have in a country that does not have an effective central government or police force. But if I have 2 minutes, I just tell you a little story about what justice actually has been for me. About a year and a half after I was released, I was taking a university program studying international development to further the Global Enrichment Foundation. And during a coffee break from classes, I checked my emails, and there was a Facebook message there from one of my captors. And he was writing to congratulate me on the work that I am doing for the Somali sisters, as he called them.
And you knew specifically which one this was.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It was very clear through his message. It was him. And receiving this message was extremely upsetting, you can imagine. And I notified the authorities, and I needed to take 2 days off of classes to process this. But fast forward a couple of years to today, and I've had time to reflect and to process and to gain some perspective. I actually think that knowing they know about the choices that I have made on the other side of this, that I have chosen compassion over hatred, and that they know that that experience did not break me, that is the best kind of justice that I could hope for, actually.
You couldn't track down his Facebook?
I leave like that in the hands of the authorities.
Thinking like a sleuth here, or at least trying to. Spirituality played a big part of this, didn't it, for you?
Yeah, my sense of spirituality was certainly strengthened when I was a hostage. And, you know, it continues to help me on this side as I'm recovering. And I don't follow any particular faith tradition. But a connection to something greater than myself saved me during many, many dark moments in captivity and is something I hang on to today. I live my life in a state of prayer now, a prayer for what I want my life to be, and also a prayer of gratitude for the life that I am so fortunate to have now.
You must look at the sky, for example, in an entire through different eyes. Or just so many things, but the sky comes immediately to mind.
I really do. It's interesting you say that, because people ask me what I missed the most when I was in captivity, and of course, family and friends and food in my country.
And beer.
But the next thing was the sky.
Yeah.
And seeing the sky now, literally every single day, it has so much meaning to me. The endless, vast beauty of that sky over our heads that I had taken for granted before that experience is such a gift to me every day, because now when I look up at the sky, I can really experience the beauty of it in a way that I never would have been able to if the sky had not been taken away from me.
I want to bring more of our listeners into this, but do you have any thoughts that you could share with us specifically about what Somalia needs, what would be most helpful to change things there, or general thoughts on Somalia now?
Well, people ask me that a lot, and I'm not in government and I'm not a policymaker. But I encourage people, you know, as individuals, we have a lot of power to create and support change in a country like Somalia. Just using the example of my own dedication to that, you know, my commitment to creating some positive change there has resulted in over 200,000 people, benefiting from our various programs. So I think a person that cares about creating change in Somalia or here in the United States or anywhere in the world and is dedicated to doing that can move mountains.
Well, let's move to some more of our callers. Jay is joining us from Stanford. Jay, welcome.
Yeah, hi, Michael. This is Jay from Concord. I just wanted to wish your guest well and wish her deep inner peace. And I just wanted to comment on something she said earlier. She said that I was able to forgive not necessarily my captors, but myself. And I just wanted to say that until you can forgive them, which is very difficult, most people cannot do that, you will never truly be free. And once you do that, it'll take you to a whole other level of inner peace and spiritual development. So I just wanted to point that out. That's all.
Okay. Thank you, Jay. Appreciate that call. And I'm going to go to some emails before I go to some more calls. She wants to know, do you have a relationship with the people who donated to help pay the ransom, and have they become involved in the nonprofit work you're doing in Somalia? Are any of them upset that you continue to travel there?
Thank you. Good questions. I have close relationships now with many of the people who contributed to my release in financial ways. And these are people that didn't know me before. So it's been a real gift to be able to expand my family to include these people. And some of them have supported the Global Enrichment Foundation and some of them haven't. And to the best of my knowledge, my benefactors understand why the work of the Global Enrichment Foundation is so important to me, and none of them have expressed any negative feelings about my choices to give back to that country, though others have. You know, others have not understood, you know, friends, for example, why I have this relentless dedication to a country where I suffered so much. And I understand that. I understand that it can be difficult for people.
I'm also wondering, since you're so much in the public eye now, and maybe that was part of what had you motivated earlier on when you were in your 20s and going on these adventures. And now with global enrichment program that you're doing and the work in Somalia that you're doing, any desire, any lingering interest in being a journalist?
No, actually, none at all. As we know, I was not especially trained or experienced at the time that I was going into Somalia, and that remains the same. But that continues to be an important story to tell, and I'll leave that to those that are better equipped to tell that story as a journalist.
Well, I have a caller named Asha, who I believe is you're Somalian, Asha?
Asha? Yes.
Yes. Hi.
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome.
Hi, Michael. Thank you. I'm from Somalia myself, and I just want to say thank you, Amanda, and my heart is went after you, because if I was the same situation when I was 14, a civil war in Somalia, and I know that what is condemning you is a tribe, and you understand that. But what is haunting me, I read the book, and also I watched it for the Dateline News for the first day you were released for this extraordinary job. But what is really haunting me, when you escaped and you get to the mosque and people was praying, and a lot of men was there. Is there anyone else who tried to save you except that a woman you talk about very much? And I can feel where she's coming from. But what's really haunting me, people who are around you and just brain that area. I'm not from Mogadishu, I'm from North Somalia, which is now Somaliland, they call now Somaliland. And that situation was a similarity when Somaliland was having a civil war in 1988 for their former president, this Mohamed Siad Barre. So it's sort of kind of really, I'm crying now and I'm shaking because I'm so over upset. And at the same time, what I really, really want you to know that how much of my heart appreciated you talking about this. And also the experience, your forgiveness you brought it for that whole nation that had been forgotten 20 years. Because right after when they release you, you go back to the, and give it back to this woman. But please answer that if you can possibly to answer. If you cannot, then it's
no,
fine.
Asha, I appreciate your call and certainly hear the emotion in your voice. Did anybody help you aside from this woman or try to help you?
Thank you. Now I'm also crying. Thank you so much for that. You know, there were many, many people in the mosque that day. But when my captors chased me into the mosque with their guns, there weren't many that stepped up to help, though there were some men that were at least trying to understand what was going on. But Asha, I don't blame them. You know, you know better than anyone, in a country like Somalia, there's little value on human life during an ongoing conflict like as is going on there. And the people in that mosque that day were probably thinking about their families and the fact that if they got involved, they might lose their lives. And I honestly don't hold it against anybody in the mosque that day that didn't step up and try to save me. And it makes what the woman did at the mosque that day all the more remarkable to think of her courage because she knew what she had to lose.
And let me thank Asha for the call. Appreciate very much your calling, Asha, and also remind you that you're listening to Forum. We're talking with the authors of House in the Sky, Amanda Lindout and Sarah Corbett. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller. Sam, join us. Hi, Sam. You're on.
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes, I just want to tell Samantha that she has a great soul. I've been in the same situation 40 years ago, imprisoned by the governments in Middle East and tortured, and one day I decided to kill myself. It didn't happen because there was another person who been tortured more than me, and I was the only person who could help him while we were in prison, and the thought of killing myself and preventing that other guy to have someone in prison to help him prevented me from killing me. And listening to Amanda, I really realize what a great soul she has. I just want to tell her that in 40 years, nothing really brought all the good thing in the world in my mind as listening to Amanda, and my hat off to you.
Thank you, Sam. I'm pleased that you called us, too. You're inspiring a lot of people with your story. Sarah, you've been getting that feedback, too.
It's been really wonderful to watch after all this time of Amanda processing her story as we put the book together, to see it go public and to realize how much it resonates for people, from people, parents and children who want to go off traveling, to people who've survived.
And we should mention, not only you already said 3.5 years, but there were a lot of people who wanted to do this story with her, and somehow you came to her in a way that really convinced her you were the one.
Mm-hmm. This story would not have been told if it wasn't for Sarah Corbett. I really wasn't sure that I wanted to reveal what had happened to me. You know, it's a difficult story. I went through a lot. And when I met Sarah and we talked about what this story really is, which isn't just this snapshot in time beginning and ending with captivity and the salacious details that everyone was waiting for, it's a bigger story of a young woman who is me, who was out in the world trying to understand herself, making mistakes, and then the transformation that occurs when all is lost. And that is a story that we both felt like is of enduring value in the world because we learn from each other. And it is this story of survival and hope that we hope will, and it seems to be, reaching and touching and moving others to think about their own lives and maybe to gain perspective and to know that they too have that strength within them to survive.
Well, you told the story, and I'm glad you did, and congratulations on it. In fact, I'm looking at a listener's comment here on our website. Incredibly inspiring interview. This young woman's tale is so moving. As an adventurer myself, who spent nearly a decade recovering from a painful wrong turn in my own 20s, I am deeply moved by Amanda's intelligence and humanity. I am eager to share her story with my own daughters. Got a couple questions about Nigel. Where is he now?
Nigel, at this very moment, is sailing around the world. Nigel and I were released at the same time, and he went back to his home and family in Australia and has continued his photojournalism. It surprises people to hear that Nigel and I don't keep in touch. In fact, we haven't talked in some time, which is not so unusual with people that have survived really traumatic events together. Maybe we're a reminder to each other of that. But Nigel and I had very different experiences in captivity, and we have processed them also quite different. But I will always be so grateful to Nigel and his family.
And I'm grateful for both of you spending this time with us. Thank you so much for being with us and telling your story. Amanda Lindau, Sarah Corbett, authors of A House in the Sky. They'll be at Book Passage and Corte Madera 1 o'clock this afternoon. We'll be back with you tomorrow if all goes according to plan. Thank you for being with us. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.